Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening. I'm Wendy Mendes, and I'm a professor here at UC San Francisco in the Department of Psychiatry and School of Medicine. And along with my co-chair, Professor Alyssa Eppel, who unfortunately isn't here tonight because she's giving a TEDMED talk down in San Diego, but imagine that she's here. As I say, we are delighted to welcome all of you to our six-week mini medical school on emotions, thoughts, and health. Over the next six sessions, you'll be hearing from some of the top researchers in the field of emotion and aging. These researchers will use a variety of research techniques, from neuroscience to cell biology, to examining facial muscles that have been linked to emotion, observational techniques, and subjective experiences. But all of them will focus on similar questions, and that is how our thoughts and emotions affect our brains and bodies, and how these relations differ across the lifespan. We're starting our series this evening with a researcher who has provided many of the foundational ideas you'll be hearing about across this series, and has revolutionized the field of emotion and aging. Professor Laura Carstensen is a professor of psychology and the Fairleigh Dickinson Professor in Public Policy at Stanford University, where she's the founding director of the Stanford Center on Longevity. Professor Carstensen is a prolific and renowned expert on emotion and aging. Indeed, in this field of research, she is a superhero, whose theory and empirical studies have informed and inspired researchers from a variety of disciplines. She's been well decorated for her achievements, winning numerous awards for teaching and research, including but not limited to a Guggenheim Fellow, a Richard Kalish Award for Innovative Research, and the Distinguished Career Award from the Gerontological Society of America. I'm thrilled to be introducing Professor Laura Carstensen, who will be talking about emotion and aging, exploding the misery myth.
Thank you, Wendy. That was very generous. No one has ever called me a superhero before. I was going to qualify that with in an introduction, but I don't think anyone's ever called me a superhero in any context before. Thank you all for being here tonight. There's a little bit of glare in my eyes, so if I look like I can't see you, it's true. what I'm going to talk about tonight are motivational changes that occur as people grow older, and the ways in which these motivational changes come to affect the decisions we make, the preferences we hold, the feelings we experience, even what we see, hear, and remember. But before I talk about motivation and emotion and aging, I want to say a little bit at the beginning of this series, especially about the demographic changes that are underway in this nation and in developed countries around the world. Now, I know that you know that people are living longer. And I know that you know that societies are getting grayer. You know, you hear about it on your television sets, you read about it in your newspapers every day. So I know you know these statistics, but I sometimes worry that we hear about them so much that we've come to accept them with a kind of a complacency. You know, I mean, what could be slower and steadier and duller than getting older and older and older? And so I want to spend just a couple minutes and see if I can convince you at just how extraordinary this historical period is, the historical period that we are living through. More years were added to average life expectancy in the 20th century than all years added across all prior millennia of human evolution combined. In historical terms, in a blink of an eye, we nearly double the length of time that we live. So if any of you feel like you haven't got this aging thing quite pegged, don't kick yourself. It's brand new. This is a remarkable change in humankind. Throughout most of human evolution, life expectancy was about 18 or 19. Some people say 20, but it's a guess. We don't know for sure. But it was short. And it was touch and go for the species, because in humans, you, of course, have to grow old enough to be able to reproduce and then hang around long enough to make sure those offspring can grow old enough to reproduce. It was touch and go for the species, for humans, for millions of years. But evolution acted on aging. It acted in the way that evolution acts, at a snail-like pace, and gradually, slowly, life expectancy gets a little bit longer, and a little bit longer, and a little bit longer. And now let's fast forward to the mid-1800s in the United States. Life expectancy had reached something like 35. 1900, life expectancy had gone to 47. And by the end of that century, life expectancy was 77. Today it's 78, and the change isn't finished with us yet. In recent years, a month has been being added to average life expectancy at 65 every year. So we're continuing to see life expectancy go up. By 2015, there will be more U.S. citizens over the age of 60 than under 15. And that's a game changer. You know, you just think about that for a minute. That is just going to change every aspect of life as we know it, the nature of family, of work, of financial markets. In fact, what is happening is that that population pyramid that we learned about in school, remember? The pyramid you can do for basically any species. You have lots at the bottom, and then as age goes up, it's winnowed to a tiny peak, those few who survive. And what is happening to this population pyramid, and this is just 1950, is that it is shifting and being rectangularized. And what this means is that for the first time in the history of the species, the majority of little ones, of babies who are born in the developed world, are having the opportunity to grow old. So there's no reason to think that we are biologically hardier than our ancestors 10,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago. What has changed is that more of us survive. More of us reach old age, and this is getting to a point where virtually all of us reach old age. So old age has become typical. It's become normative. One of my favorite jokes is from a cartoon where there are two women sitting on a park bench, and one of them, two old women, and one of them turns to the other and says, "I'm getting so old, my friends in heaven are going to think I didn't make it." But we have no excuse anymore. All of us in this room, you in this room, can anticipate living to very old ages, making some guesses about your backgrounds, your affluence, your education levels. I can say that, you know, most of you are going to sail into your 80s, 90s, and lots of people in this room are going to live to be 100. And that's the change that has occurred. That's the change that's underway. And this is extraordinary. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. I mean, this is remarkable. Adding 30 years on average to life expectancy, more time to realize our goals, to spend time with our family, to pursue our dreams, this is remarkable. And it's a good thing, this increase in life expectancy. But individuals are worried about their own aging, and societies, policymakers are panicking. Wondering what they will do when there are more walkers than strollers on the sidewalks. So how is it that we're so negative about this, given how extraordinary the advance is? I thought I would sum up the research on aging for you in a single slide. You can see on the y-axis any variable you like, and as age goes out, we see a decline. Now, certainly, this is the hypothesis that guides most research on aging in the social sciences and the biological sciences. I would like to tell you this is all wrong, but I can't. There are a lot of problems that happen with aging, and although we've been handed this gift of time, it's hardly time to rest on our laurels. We've got a lot of problems to solve, but we do have the most spectacular opportunity ever any generations of humans have had. Well, when I started my work in the field of aging, I certainly was being trained in this tradition that you see represented here on this slide. I was in graduate school, and I was studying both lifespan developmental psychology and clinical psychology. I was learning in my courses in clinical that social isolation is associated with depression, with anxiety, with basically, you know, any mental health disorder. You see more social isolation. And I was learning in my courses in lifespan development that as people get older, they interact with others less. And I thought, aha, that's the reason why. Older people are depressed and lonely, discouraged, because they aren't interacting with other people as much. And so I decided I was going to chase those two postulates or ideas and see if they might be linked. And what I will tell you now is that both of these assumptions proved to be entirely untenable. but if I have one thing to say for myself, it's that I do find results of studies to be interesting and informative. And so I kept asking these questions, trying to find where the pathology was and what the roots of the problems were. And although I was completely wrong in my assumptions at that time, I like to think that we learned a little bit along the way. For example, older people are happy. Older people are happier than younger middle-aged people and younger people. You want to see real unhappiness, look at 20-somethings, 30-somethings. I mean, they are unhappy. You see much higher rates of clinical depression, anxiety, phobia, anything in people in that age group than you do in people over 65. Here are findings from a survey from the CDC, not from our group, but this was a simple question. Have you experienced significant psychological distress in the last 2 weeks? And older people answered that affirmatively, significantly less than middle-aged people do and less than younger people do as well. There are a lot of surveys showing the same finding. A lot of studies have now been published comparing two different generations or three different generations and asking them in one way or another how satisfied they are with life or how emotionally well off they are and so on and so forth. Most of these studies are what we call cross-sectional. They're comparing people at different ages at one point in time. And so you worry when you see findings like this coming out in study after study that it could be that the greatest generation is and always was the greatest generation. That there isn't a within-person developmental improvement. It's just we're comparing different generations, and some generations are do better than other generations. You could also imagine that people are answering survey questions like this with a little bit of rationalization. Maybe older people have lower standards. You know, so you say, how are you doing today? And it's like, great, you know, I got out of bed. And so people questioned these kinds of surveys and thought, you know, maybe this really isn't what's going on. And so years ago, a little over 15 years ago now, my students and colleagues and I began a longitudinal study so we could look at people within themselves over time. And instead of asking them these general survey type questions, we used what's called an experience sampling methodology. And this is considered the gold standard of emotional sampling, a sampling of emotional experience. Because you can imagine if I say to you right now, how happy are you? you go into a kind of cognitive mode. You know, you're going to compare yourself to other things earlier. You know, it's a very intellectual question. But if I say to you, right now on a 1 to 7 scale, how happy are you from 1 to 7? It's a different question. So we really can try to prod people and say, right now, what are you feeling? So we recruited a sample of people aged 18 to 94. And we asked them to carry an electronic pager for a week, and at 5 times a day, at random times selected, we paged them, and every time they were paged, they told us the extent to which they were feeling each of 19 different emotions. Some were positive, some were negative. And then 5 years later, we recruited those same people. They came back to the laboratory. We set this up again. They carried the pager for a week. We get another 7 days of data, and 5 years later, same people come back. So we're following people over time, and here's what we find. We still see this increase in how positive people are. So the higher scores here are more positive. And, you know, this y-axis actually diminishes the differences here. You're going from, you know, about 0.2 to, you know, about 0.5. here, and the degree of positivity. So people are getting more positive, reporting more positive emotions and fewer negative emotions in their day-to-day lives. You see a little bit of a decline here. That's not a statistically significant decline, but you do see it in most studies. So you see a little bit of diminishment of this positive experience in very, very advanced ages. But at no point does it return to this level in the 20s, 30s. Nobody wants to be 20 again. I've asked a lot of people that question. How old do you want to be? So we were entirely wrong. I was entirely wrong and convinced of that after seeing the results of this study, but also hundreds of other studies along the way, that people overall, older people, are doing better in terms of emotional well-being. They're also more stable, less bumping around. And it's not like people are becoming emotionally flat and just not experiencing emotions. In fact, older people are more likely to experience mixed emotions. Happiness with a little bit of sadness. You know, it's that tear in your eye when you see an old friend and you're happy beyond happy. But there's a tinge of sadness often accompanied with it. So emotional life becomes richer, more complex, deeper over time. So the other idea I had as I was starting this is that older people were socially isolated. So now we're thinking, well, if they're socially isolated, how can they be so happy? And we started to look at social networks more closely. And we were certainly not the first to show this decline, this negative slope in the size of people's social networks. This had been shown many times before Frieder Lang, my colleague on this project, and I got to this, but people tended to count all the different social partners similarly. And what we did was to ask people to tell us, name the people in their social network to whom they were so close they couldn't imagine life without. That's this very close group. And then in the next circle out, people you're pretty close to, but not that close, is the, you know, the inner circle. And you keep going out in these circles. And then we looked at social networks. And this is a group of people 69 to 104. And you do see this steep decline in the overall size. But there's actually not a significant change in the inner circle. So there's less of a decline in contact as people get older with people to whom they're very close, people that they have a strong emotional connection. So if you computed the ratio of emotional closeness or the density of a network, it actually gets increasingly dense with people you care a lot about as you get older. And we've done some other work asking people how these changes came about, what they were thinking. And it looks like there are a lot of people in social networks who appear there for some reason other than they are your soulmate or possible soulmate. They're the parents of your children's friends. They're coworkers. They're people you like, you care about, some. Others, not so much. And it looks like what happens as people get older is they're increasingly selective about those people who belong in that social network, the people who they're going to take the time for and invest in. And so they come to let the more peripheral people go. When you first look at these numbers, some people say, yeah, it's because people died. You know, and there is loss because of death. Certainly as we get older, all of us know that. But you wouldn't think that people who are less close to you die more than people who are close to you. And in fact, Frieda Lang, who was my collaborator on this first study, followed these same people 5 years later and asked them the same questions, you know, who's in your social network? And had brought along with him on the interview what they had said 5 years earlier. And anybody who wasn't mentioned the second time, he said, you know, last time you said Bob was in there. And how come? And the most common reason that people gave was, you know, I'm not so crazy about Bob. So it was a voluntary kind of a shift that we saw in what people were doing. So a lot of people in the field called this combination of effects, that is, smaller social networks, along with a lot of other bad stuff that happens as people get older. I mean, loss of social status, death of loved ones, physical illness. There's a lot that goes wrong with age. We know this. But people are doing better in terms of well-being. And a lot of people came to call this and write about what's called the paradox of aging. This preservation or improvement in well-being despite losses that come with age. Well, we thought a lot about this combination of factors. And you know, in my group, we were really used to being wrong. So we'd gone study after study trying to test these hypotheses or ideas that we had believed when we began. And we started thinking that maybe this wasn't a paradox at all, but rather that as people get older, motivation shifts, they're interested in different things, they're making more selective choices about what they do, what goals they pursue, and because of those kinds of changes, they come to experience life more positively. And we began to think about time, and this was really because we interviewed an awful lot of people after they participated in studies where we weren't supporting our hypotheses, and we'd say, well, why aren't you interacting more? You know, wouldn't that be great, you know, if you could have a larger social net and so on and so forth? And people kept talking to me about time, and they'd say things like, I don't have time for those people. And, you know, I was like in my 20s when I was starting this line of research, and I'd look at them and kind of go, you look like you got a lot of time on your hands to me. And it took a long time, but it finally dawned on me that they weren't talking about time in the day. They were talking about time left in life. And you start to think about making really new, close friends. And if it's somebody brand new and you're 80 years old, the numbers don't work. You know, is the prospects of close acquaintances, new ones, is lessened. And it may be that people were really somehow thinking about time. Now, you know, humans are uniquely able to monitor time. To the best of our knowledge, we're the only species that monitors lifetime. Now, other species certainly monitor clock time, calendar time. Of course, we know that. But we all in this room can appreciate our own mortality. We know we're not going to be here forever, and we have a kind of a running clock going on. And all of us have some estimate about how much time we've got left. It's not very specific, and we know, of course, there are no guarantees. But we sort of think we have a certain amount of time left, and we set goals accordingly. So goals are always set in temporal context, always, any kind of goal. You know, my goal for this evening and talking with you all is different than if we were beginning a 10-week seminar. You know, we always set our goals. You run into somebody in the hallway out here and you're rushing into a lecture. You have a different kind of conversation than if you sat down next to them on a park bench on a nice sunny day. So we always have our goals framed in some temporal context. And we started to think, you know, if... because of the chronological, the association, let me say, between chronological age and time left in life, we may see a shift in goals because the type of goals that are realized in the short term are different than goals that are realized in the long term. This theory is called socio-emotional selectivity theory. And what we argue is that time's passage changes our perspective on our own life and our own lifespan, and that when we're young, Time seems to just stretch endlessly out before us. We have these long and nebulous futures that are hard to predict. We don't know what'll happen. And when we see time in that way, when we understand time to be vast, we tend motivationally to be in a kind of a banking mode. We need to learn and acquire information and knowledge because it might pay off somewhere down the line. We can get young people, for example, to study inorganic chemistry. Some of them love it. Love it. But they are the minority. A lot of them are taking it because it's going to open a door somewhere down the line. You can't get 80-year-olds to take inorganic chemistry. Early in life, in a social sense, we're also willing to take risks. Young people, they'll go on blind dates. Stanford students tell me sometimes they'll date people they don't like because it's interesting to figure out why. You know, people over 50, they don't do that. You don't have time to mess around. So younger people go to mixers and parties. They join teams, clubs, like to expand their horizons, learn new information, travel. And as people get older and or perceive time as becoming more constrained, see time horizons shrinking, rather than become depressed and dejected, worried about time running out, in some sense, as people come to see time horizons shrinking, they're relieved of the burden of preparing for the future. And you can start to live in the day. You can stop and smell the roses. When people perceive time as limited in some way, they see very clearly what's important and what's not. Older people and or people, younger people, who see time as limited tend not to get terribly distressed by those hassles that can make the young ones ruminate for days and hours. But rather focus on what really matters. And for most people, what really matters are other people, that inner circle of people that you can't imagine life without. And so people begin to get more selective, and it tends to be good for mental health. So the way we're seeing this now is that these two phenomena that we were so wrong about, that is improved psychological well-being and a smaller social network, a smaller core of people in one's life, are related, but not in the way that we thought they would be related when we embarked on this research journey years ago. Marriages improve, by the way, when time horizons shorter. People can let those really irritating qualities of your spouses go. You know, it's you start to say, you know, we don't have all the time in the world, and it's easier to forgive. It's easier to feel grateful, and we see those changes emotionally as well with age. Well, when we started developing this theory, one of the first things that we had to do was to show that goals do change as a function of time, time horizons. And so we began a series of studies where we manipulated time horizons experimentally. So here's the basic paradigm. And I tell you, we did dozens of these kinds of studies, some version of them or another. But essentially, we would say, to younger and older people, we want you to imagine that the following three people are available to you behind door number one, door number two, door number three. You've got 30 minutes free. Which person do you choose to spend your time with? And one, we spent years doing research to identify these types of social partners, but one is often, you know, a member of your family or a close friend. Another would be the author of a book you've just read. And another would be an acquaintance with whom you seem to have much in common. So that third is, you know, sort of promises the fantasy of a future. You know, they might pay off somewhere, but in the long run. An author of a book you just read tends to be high on information value and relatively low on emotional closeness. A member of your family, for better or for worse, for most people, that's an emotionally significant person. So we ask younger and older people that question. Younger people reply sort of evenly, randomly, random rates across those three different social partners. Older people, not so. Older people choose a member of their immediate family or a close friend. And we said that's because that's who they're invested in. You know, time horizons are shorter, and you can say, yeah, but it could just be that nobody else will talk to the old people. You know, they're going to talk to their, you know, close friends or family. Or you could say it isn't that, it's not what they want. It's just what they feel most comfortable with or something like that. So there are all these different. We're saying, no, it's time. And so we then would add a condition to these studies, and we would say, now I want you to imagine you're about to move across country. You're going by yourself without family or friends. You're in the middle of packing, but you find yourself with 30 minutes free, following three people available. Who do you choose? Same three options. We've limited time for younger people now. And what we find when we ask them this question, who do you choose? They choose to spend time with a member of their immediate family or a close friend. So with this simple sort of manipulation of time, younger people respond as older people do. We thought, this is great. We can get younger people to look like older people really fast, you know, so it's cool. We thought, well, could we get older people to reply like younger people? And so we ran this condition. I want you to imagine that you just got a phone call from your physician who's told you about a medical advance that virtually ensures you'll live about 30 years longer than you expected in relatively good health. Following three people are available to you. Who do you choose? Older people, no preference for their close friends or family. Gone. In fact, in one study, they actually had a lower rate of choosing that than younger people did. Younger people thought it'd be cool to call their parents and tell them, you know, about the new medical advance. So we can eliminate that effect. So what we're arguing with this theory is that it's not about age, it's not chronological age, it's not about a generation. But rather, this is about time horizons and how people experience life when time horizons are long and vast and nebulous, and when time horizons are more certain, but also shorter. Well, these were, you know, laboratory-based, hypothetical studies. But we have now over the years, mostly Helene Fung has over the years, run so many of these studies that when something happens like a natural disaster, 9/11, a SARS outbreak, she has baseline data on these choices. And then she'll quickly run a study, say when the SARS epidemic broke out in Hong Kong, and finds that younger people in Hong Kong no longer want to spend time with authors and recent acquaintances in focus. After the epidemic had passed by about 6 months, they were now responding as they had before, picking choices that looked like they were about the future, banking on the future. After 9/11, same thing. Younger people wanted to focus on close friends and members of their immediate family. It took about 6 months and it went away. So time sort of expanded again for people. So we've seen this both in experiments where we tightly control all these different factors, but also under naturalistic conditions where we see events that remind people of the fragility of life. Well, we began to think about how these changes in time horizons might also change the kinds of information that people process, attend to, remember. Because your brains don't operate like a computer. Brains don't take in all information evenly, but they selectively process and attend to information that's relevant to our goals. So if people as they get older are pursuing different goals than people who are younger, and they are, then we would see systematic changes in the types of information that people process and remember. That was the general thinking. So in one of the first studies that we did examining the effects of these changes on cognitive processing, we worked with an advertising agency to develop pairs of advertisements that were identical in every way, that is, each in the set, except for the slogan. So advertisers know that if they want you to get buy a product, they should tell you that that product will help you realize your dreams. So, and one, we say capture the unexplored world. This is a camera ad. And the other in that pair says capture those special moments. So we change the slogan only from one that's emotionally meaningful to one that's about exploration information. So here's another example. This is a watch ad. Success is within reach. Don't let time pass you by. Take time for the ones you love. Don't let time pass you by. So we would show a series of these advertisements to people and later ask them to tell us which ones they preferred and which ones they remembered. Well, the preferences were clear. Older people are what you see here in the red bar, and older people overwhelmingly preferred the advertisements that had emotionally meaningful slogans, that were promising emotional rewards. So this was the preference. Now, again, you could say this is a generational effect. This is a cohort effect. It's just that people from different generations like different kinds of things. And so, and another spin off this line of research, before we ask people to tell us which of them they liked better, we said, I want you to imagine you just got a phone call from your physician, told you about a new medical advance, you're going to live 20 years longer in relatively good health, and then which one of these do you like? And this effect of older people liking the emotional slogans better and those advertisements disappears. We now know see no difference in the preferences of older and younger people for these different kinds of advertisements. But, of course, what we were really interested in was memory. What did they remember? And certainly those are all the marketing people were watching us, you know, and talking with us about the study. What do they remember? And for younger people, it doesn't make any difference whether they're emotionally meaningful slogans or knowledge-related slogans. They remember the slogans just as well. And the products. You get the same findings for products. So these are slogans, products, same thing. But here's what happens for older people. We do see this difference. Older people remember the slogans, the emotional meaningful ones, better than the ones that are knowledge-related or expansive, exploring. And, you know, we started thinking, this was interesting, because you all know that memory declines with age. And it does. And, we have data from our studies, too, that it does. But we started to think, you know, I think we may be putting older people at a disadvantage in these memory studies. Because here's the typical memory study on cognitive aging. You walk into a laboratory. It says memory laboratory first on the door. So, you know, you make it clear. And you know this isn't going to go well, you know, if you're older. You know. And you come in, and then they say, here's this long list of words we want you to remember. Now, those words have nothing to do with anything you've ever seen. Sometimes the researchers make up new words to make sure you've never seen them before. So these are nonsense words. And you know, the remarkable thing is, younger people will remember them. I think that's actually more remarkable than the fact that older people don't do so well. So now, again, don't misunderstand me. There are changes in memory, but I do believe that most of our studies are putting people at a disadvantage, because if you present information to people that they don't care about, that isn't relevant to them, then they're less likely to remember it, to process it. And we started thinking, given these changes and goals where with age, people are putting more priority on things that really matter, emotionally meaningful information and goals, than younger people do, that they may process emotional information differently than younger people do. And we thought it might be that older people attend to and remember all kinds of emotional information better, but it could be that with age, we come to focus on positive information, positive stimuli. Because if your goals are feeling good, if your goals are about well-being, well, what you notice in life and what you retrieve from your memory influences how you feel. So maybe people are motivated to attend to positive information more than negative information. So I'll tell you, after many studies in our laboratory, but lots of studies now in laboratories around the world, we call the effect the positivity effect. It does appear that relative to younger people, older people process and attend to positive information. We think your brain is coming to operate, process information in the service of emotion regulation. Those are the goals, and so this is what we see. We've shown this now with images. We've shown it with an autobiographical memory. We've shown it with faces. You show people positive, older people positive and negative information, they tend to look to the positive. Looking at the positive aspects of life, it's good for mental health. It's good for emotional well-being. So here's an example of a study. We show people on a computer screen images that are negative and positive. Some are high arousal. Some are low arousal, you know, sadness versus fear. They only see one image at a time. So you're seeing this. This is just to have fewer slides here for you. But you see one of those images. You'd look at a lot of them if you're participating in our studies. We wouldn't tell you it's a memory study at all. We just ask you to go through and look at these different images in the laboratory. And then after you're done, we say, tell us all the images that you can remember. So here are results from one of the first studies we ran with younger, middle-aged, and older people. In all age groups, the emotional images, which are in the orange and the blue, I think this doesn't go on anymore. Are remembered better than the neutral ones. So the beige color are neutral. But younger people remember just the same number of positive and negative images. In middle age, we already see this positivity effect, as we call it, emerge, where there's a significant advantage in memory of positive images. But look in older adults. You see this whopping effect, where they're remembering more positive images than negative or neutral images. And what I like to point out is that this comparison here, this neutral bar to these bars, that's the typical aging memory study, right? It's not emotional at all. It's just neutral information, devoid of any. But positive information, much better retained. Well, in this study, we don't know if it's retrieval, memory, or attention. That is, are people not paying attention in the first place, or are they not retrieving information that has been attended to and stored? And so with John Gabrielli, a former colleague of mine at Stanford who's now at MIT, and who is a neuroscientist, we ran another study where we showed people these same images but asked them to view the images while they were in a brain scanner. So using functional magnetic resonance imaging, we're able to see activation in different regions of the brain while they're viewing the images. So this wasn't when they were remembering the images, it's while they're looking at the images during the viewing time. And the amygdala is the region of the brain that's involved in storing emotion memories. And so that's where we expected to see activation as they were imaging, as they were viewing positive and negative. And this is what we see with younger people. So you see, these are the neutral images, essentially no increase in activation in the amygdala. But when they see positive or negative images, you see this activation in amygdala. Here's what happens with older people. You see activation to the positive ones, nothing to the negative ones. So it looks like the information isn't being stored, isn't being deeply processed in a way that will later be remembered. Now, when we ran this study, there had only been one other study in the literature where they showed people emotional images and looked at amygdala activation, but they had only used negative images. So imagine this red bar is gone, and what they concluded was, one more thing that goes wrong with age. The amygdala doesn't work. Now, many people say the amygdala is actually, we think of it as involved in emotion, but it's really involved in information that's salient, relevant. Some, you could call it a salience indicator, too. And it looks like there's a difference in what is considered salient. So we're thinking about this now as a top-down process, motivation affecting cognitive processing. We ran another study to look more closely at attention. And participants come into the laboratory and they see on a computer screen just what you're seeing there. There are always two photographs. It's always of the same person. And one is neutral one pose is neutral, and the other will be negative, angry, sad, fearful, or positive. And in this study, we were interested in how quickly people would respond to the position of a dot when those images disappeared. So the faces appear on the screen for half a second. They disappear, and a dot is behind one of those images. And all the participant has to do in this study is to hit a key to the right of the keyboard or the left of the keyboard to say where the dot was. Everybody gets it right. You know, it's a high accuracy study. But what we're interested in is the reaction time to hit that key. Because if you're already looking at the angry face and that's where the dot is, you're faster than if you're looking away from it. And here's what we find, younger and older people. For younger people, it makes no difference. They're just as fast, whether that dot appears behind a positive face or a negative. But for older people, they're faster when the dot appears behind a smiling, happy face, and slower when it appears behind an angry, fearful face. So it looks like older people are looking away from negative images and looking toward, orienting toward positive images. We began to think about autobiographical memory. People remember the past generally pretty positive. And we don't know a whole lot about autobiographical memory compared to short-term memory, in part because it's really hard to know whether what people tell you is correct. So we do know that older people talk about their past more positively than younger people do. But again, could be it was more positive in days gone by than it is currently. So you don't really know. I had conducted a study with the School Sisters of St. Francis in Milwaukee in the late 1880s. I'm actually not that old. 1980s. And doing research with Catholic nuns is great because they'll do anything you ask them, and they're just really reliable. We gave them a 26-page questionnaire about their lifestyles, their friendships, their emotional well-being, on, and they completed all of them. It was just great. And so one of my former graduate students, Quinn Kennedy, decided that we had a lot of information that people had reported. It was then about 17 years later. And so she went back to the sisters, to the nuns, and said, I want you to complete this 26-page questionnaire just as you did 17 years earlier. And so they did, of course. And we're so grateful. I mean, they're just wonderful people to study, and in all sorts of ways, of course. But we then divided them, median split, half the youngest and the oldest, and compared what they had told us earlier, years earlier, to what they said now. And what we find is what you see here, that the relatively younger nuns remembered the past more negatively than they had reported it. They didn't have as many friends. They were more depressed, more upset than they had told us. And the older nuns remembered the past more positively than they had told us. Life was better. So we see this even when we're comparing it to accuracy. Now, as some of you I know were thinking as I was describing this study, this isn't really a memory study. People make this stuff up, right? I mean, you can't remember what you said on a questionnaire, you know, more than a decade earlier. But in some ways, that is what autobiographical memory is, by the way. I mean, it's what most of us are doing when we're thinking about our past. We're drawing on all sorts of contextual information and spinning a story. But it's a great projective, right? So we're saying, you know, when you ask people to do that, what are the stories they're constructing? And older people are tending to pull together a more positive story than younger people do when they're asked to do the same task. So we've seen evidence for this positivity effect in all sorts of ways, and all sorts of different kinds of context. I do go till 8:45, right?
Yeah.
That's a long time. Okay, I'm going to keep talking. I'm actually not going to talk for another 45 minutes. I'm going to stop pretty soon, but I want to tell you about a couple more studies before I do. But we started thinking, you know, all developmental change has beneficial consequences and negative consequences. You know, little kids go from crawling to walking. That's a good thing. But, you know, walking is dangerous, you know, for these little ones, right? There's always a downside to everything that changes. We thought, well, this is a good thing, we think, for emotional well-being, the shift in motivation and attention. We think this is good for emotion. But if people, any group of people, you know, sort of has goals that are about well-being that are shifting their attention away from what's negative toward what's positive, there could be contexts where that's not a good thing. Let's say you're choosing your health care plan and you focus on what's good about the plan and not what's bad about the plan. You could make a bad choice. We think, although we're just beginning this line of research, that older people may be more susceptible to financial fraud. You know, the charming young guy knocks on your door, comes every day. So nice. And if you're less likely to focus on what could be bad about this, what focus on risk, it could put older people at risk. And we thought there might even be something about winning and losing money that changes with age. That is, does anticipatory affect, what you expect to feel when you win money or you lose money, does that change? And we've done some research. This is in collaboration with Brian Knutson, and Greg Simonis-Larkin is the lead author on it, who's now at Vanderbilt, was a graduate student in our program. We ran this study that suggests that it is the case that older people are less upset at the prospect of losing money than winning money. So let me show you what we did. This is a paradigm that Brian Knutson developed. It's called the monetary incentive delay task. And it's a task that's, it's a game, and it's played in the brain scanner. So again, we're going to look at activation in the brain as people play this game. And what happens is people really win or lose money while they play the game. So you're in the scanner, and what you see is a cue that says, on the next trial, you're going to win money. So this one's $5. It would go all the way down to 25 cents, $5 maximum. You get that cue, there's a delay, a pause, and then this target appears. And when that target appears in your view, you have to push a key real fast. And if you are fast, and then there's another delay, if you're fast, you win $5. And then there's a pause, and it starts over again. There are also trials intermixed where you might lose $5 down to 25 cents. So you see the cue, delay, target appears, push a button, and then you get this feedback, up, you lost $5. So this game goes pretty quickly. It's rigged for every person, so everybody wins and loses. But everybody actually ends up winning some money in this. So our participants do end up winning overall. But they win and lose. So we see different trials where you just lost money or you just won money. And we were interested in brain activation and regions associated with anticipatory affect, anticipatory reward, and comparing younger and older people. So I'm going to just quickly show you this is what we're interested in. So it's this delay. After you see the stimulus, before you hit the target, it's this time period where there's that delay. That's where we're interested in what your brain's doing. Okay, is it getting excited about this prospect, or is it not doing anything? And we find that on trials where people may gain, this is a win trial. These are younger brains over here, older brains over here to the right. And the activation patterns look very similar. So we saw no real difference on gain trials in younger and older brains in regions like anterior insula and medial caudate. Here's loss trials. Younger people, you're seeing the same activations on loss trials in these same regions. And here's older brains. There's just like nothing going on. This loss. The loss is not potent, if you will. The anticipatory loss. Now, let me add that when people did lose, older people, younger people did lose, no differences by age. So it's not that it doesn't matter. I think of the finding or the message from this study is, I don't go there. You know? If I lose, I'll deal with it. But to experience negative affect in response to a possible loss, not so much. So we think that there probably are downsides to this positivity effect. We started wondering whether we could eliminate it with changes in goals. Because, again, theoretically, we think this is all being driven by goal changes as a function of time horizons. Corinna Lockenhoff, a former student who's now a professor at Cornell, this was her dissertation, brings younger and older people into the laboratory, and she asks them to make a choice about different healthcare plans. And they see what you see on this screen before them, these color-coded rectangles, and they take a mouse, and when you click on the mouse, it gives you the information about that plan. So if you want to know about what Plan A does for preventive care, click, and it turns around and tell you. In the dark boxes, you see negative information about the plans. In the light boxes, you see positive information about the plans. And in the neutral ones, you see neutral information about the plans. And people are just asked to review the information. And what we find is that younger people review pretty evenly. So this is zero. This means there's no real difference between reviewing positive and negative boxes. So they're looking at both about the same. Older people, they're looking at the positive information. So clicking on a box that you know is going to tell you something good about the plan, and that's what we see. Now, older people, everybody in the study clicked on all the boxes. So everybody, all the boxes get turned over to look at what's there, but the older people keep going back to look at what's good about the plan. This is for well-being. You know, this is cognition operating in the service of emotional well-being. Look at what's good. We wanted to see if we could eliminate that effect. Because, and by the way, there are and still are some people who are saying this whole positivity effect is not driven by motivation. It's driven by some neural degradation that's only affecting the processing of negative information. And it goes like, the story goes like this. Negative information is more complex. It's harder to process it. So older people just do the easy default, go to positive. Well, we just changed the goals in this study. What we did in this next study is that we said to people, we want you to be really accurate as you make this choice. And every once in a while, a little reminder of that goal would pop on the top of the computer screen, and it would say, remember, try to be as accurate as you can in comparing these different plans. So we changed the goal from one about feeling good to one about information. And when we did that, we found that there was no difference in the review of these plans in older and younger people. So we're again beginning to think that it's like there's a chronically activated default goal. You know, when you can, look on the bright side. And it's good for well-being. That's good. But it's not that older people can't look at the negative. But it does look like we may need reminders as we get older to do that. Because the tendency is to look away from what's negative. Well, I hope I'm convincing you that there's some pretty good news about emotional well-being as people get older. I think older people should know this because this is good news. It's reassuring. And generally, when I talk to older crowds, they're happy about that. You know, it's like, yeah. You see a lot of people kind of nodding like, yeah, that seems right. You know, and so this is good. But young people need to know this information. Young people really need to know this information because for most younger people, they can't even imagine being old. They really can't. You know, I ask students this all the time. I say, you know, I want you to imagine yourself. These are Stanford students. I say, imagine yourself at 40. And it takes them a while, but they do. And after they think for a while, they do. And I say, what are you imagining? They say themselves, only with more money and better cars, fancier cars. So they can do that. Then I say, okay, 50. I want you to imagine yourself at 50. It gets a little hazy. 60? Very hazy. 78 is gone. They just can't do it. It's not even, it's just blurry. It's just a blank. And I think it's that people believe in this misery myth. You know, and so why would they focus on this time in life that's going to be so bleak? And why would they put off doing what they want to do today so they might have a little money when they're old. Why would they do that? If you think you're going to be depressed and dejected and alone, and you know, why would you? Why not? Travel now, spend now. You know, run up that credit card debt. So we think that when people are making choices and planning for their own futures, they're not willing to put a lot of they're put off a lot of rewards that they could get in the short term for the long term, because A, it's hard to imagine it in the first place, and then when they do imagine it, it doesn't seem so good. Okay, we bring Stanford students into a virtual reality laboratory. This is at Jeremy Balinson's lab, a collaborator of ours. He's in the communications department at Stanford. We also worked with Bill Sharp, who's a Nobel laureate in economics. We were thinking about ways we could get younger people maybe to save more money for their own futures, to take care of their future selves better. And so they come into the laboratory, and we take their photograph. This is Hal Erstner-Hirschfield. He's actually now at NYU and School of Marketing. He was a former graduate student at Stanford who ran this study. He's really the lead. But this is just a photograph of him that we do for the participants in the study. So that's what it looks like. We first take the snapshot, and then we create a digital avatar. And that avatar is either young in one condition, so it looks like the person as they are now, or older. So in one condition, we morph their avatar to about age 60. And then they put on this virtual reality headgear that creates the perception that they're in an apartment. The apartment has a mirror that covers one whole wall of the apartment. And they go in there and they just walk around for about 30 minutes. So that every time they look at this wall, they see themselves, and whoever's looking back, it's their old self or their current age self. When they move their arm up, they see, you know, the avatar moves their arm up. When they smile, the avatar smiles. And then after they've done this for about 30 minutes, we ask them a lot of questions. But embedded among those many questions is a question that goes like this. If you had $1,000 today, how much of it would you allocate to your retirement fund? And those students who had interacted with their older avatar put more than twice as much money into retirement. Now, we don't think that we're going to put every young person in this country into a VR study. But we do think that it points to the need to create a visceral connection with ourselves in the future. When people can't connect to their future selves, they tend to treat their future selves the same way they would strangers. Can you live on Social Security? Sure. Would you want to next year? No. You know. So we need to build this connection, and we think that this points to one way, one avenue that we might be able to do it, to really kind of build this connection. So Hal sent me findings from another study that he's done following this one up just the other day. So these are fresh off the press. But what Hal decided to do was to see if that older avatar, if it mattered whether the avatar was happy or not. And so in this study, everybody gets their photographed, or the digital avatar is old, but sometimes the digital avatar has a neutral face, sometimes a sad face, and sometimes a happy face. And guess who the younger people save the most for? It's their happy future selves. So when people have something to look forward to, a stage in life where not everything gets worse, but some things get a lot better, we think that they'll prepare better for the future. So I'm going to leave you with a thought about aging societies. So I've been talking a lot about aging individuals, but societies are getting older. And as I said when I began, mostly there's concern. There's concern that we're going to live in a world that is top-heavy with frail, dependent, incapacitated older people. And I will say that we have a lot of work to do scientifically, technologically, to solve problems. So we got a lot of work to do. But we should not just be looking at what goes wrong. We should be beginning to think about what a society might look like that has more people over 60 than under 15, where those people over 60 are emotionally stable, in good mental health, have raised their own families and their kids, put that behind them, are beginning to look at life in terms of what really matters, seeing that very clearly, and pursuing those kinds of goals. And if we begin to entertain the possible opportunities of that kind of a society, and we manage to get all hands on deck, older societies could be the best thing that ever happened to society, and certainly the best thing that ever happened to children. I'm going to stop. I'm going to leave you with a picture of my book. This is just, you know, a blatant advertisement. If you want the longer version of the story, it's on, you know, Kindle and Amazon and all those different places. I want to thank you for your attention. You've been wonderful to listen to this time. Thank you. To paraphrase your question, what about all those grumpy old men and women, right? Yeah. There are some. And almost every time I give a talk like this, somebody says, you know, you got to meet my grandmother because... And here's the finding, basically. People who are what psychologists would call neurotic, high negativity, focusing always on the bad, tend not to benefit from age in the way that the majority of people do. And there are even some studies of, you know, sort of reinforcement learning in people who are negative. They tend not to attend to the rewards. They don't learn, you know, as well about life and things where rewards come. So it looks like there is a subgroup of people, but it's pretty small, but there is a subgroup of people who don't seem to show these benefits. It is typical, however. So typically, for the majority of people we're seeing, do show these positive benefits. Now, everyone, again, also starts at a different level on the well-being scale. So if you start up here, you're going like this. If you start down here, you're still pretty low relative to others. So there certainly are individual differences, but most people seem to be getting better. Yes?
I feel that because I've lived so long and had a lot of experience, I get impatient with people who haven't been there and they're, you know, I just get impatient with slow behavior or whatever. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm neurotic.
No, you're not old enough. Just wait. Give it some time. No, your question is a serious one. It is, you know, you can imagine, you know, just you get irritated with other people who aren't, let's say you are improving, you are more reasoned, you don't let the little things get you down, but you're around people who do get down, and that's irritating, is what you're saying, if I understand right. One of the best ways that you can regulate your emotions is through what psychologists would call antecedent emotion regulation. So this is a not experiencing that in the first place. So, and I think this social selection, remember that slide where your social network gets smaller and you're eliminating a lot of those people in life? Get rid of the negative people. I mean, that is what most older people are doing. Most people with age, they're getting rid of those folks. Yes. Yeah. So to repeat the question, it's what's the dividing line between selectivity and a positive sort of shift in goals and experience and being just delusional? You know, you remember the past, everything's fine, but none of it's true. So is that, I have that right? These effects, this positivity effect, is greatest in people with the highest level of cognitive functioning, executive functioning. So you're seeing, and again, some people, there is an alternative theory here that I should mention that floats around a lot, and that's that older people, I think I mentioned it in passing, focus on what's positive because it's easier to process. They can't process the hard stuff. I think of it as the village idiot, you know, approach to happiness. You kind of, oh, good, you know. The positivity effect isn't being explained by that well because, again, you measure executive function, how well people can plan and deploy resources toward goals. You measure that, it's the people with most of that who show this positivity the most. So there's a different group of people than people who are delusional and incapacitated. So we're seeing that in one group. There's certainly, is a group of older adults who suffer from dementia, and delusional processes are often a part of that. We don't believe that we would see the positivity effect in people with dementia. But I think it's probably just an altogether different phenomenon. What you're saying happens, of course, and to some people. I think generally they have either a long-standing psychotic disorder, you know, some sort of an underlying serious psychiatric disorder, or are developing a dementia. So I think that's the these different trajectories. Abnormal.
And what you're talking about is your selectivity theory, it's the normal.
Right. Yeah.
People who are still functioning.
Yeah.
Can opt for that.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. The question is, who are you studying here? You know, and I do think people occasionally, I love it when people ask me, because I forget to say this, and people think we just study like Stanford professors, the emeriti or something like that. So we for all the studies I described to you, we've recruited our participants through a survey research firm that does this for us. And they recruit for us, the samples are African-American and European-American. We've focused on just those two groups, because if we focus on all the ethnicities in the Bay Area, you end up with one of, you know, 100. You know, so we've really focused on those two groups, so we do have enough people to make those comparisons across at least two ethnic groups, two racial groups. And 50-50, male-female, and one-third blue-collar workers, two-thirds white-collar workers. And we made it that distribution because when we began this sampling method, which we've now used across all these studies, that was the distribution in the Bay Area. It isn't anymore, but that's what we began with. And we stratify gender, race, and socioeconomic status across age. So we have just as many elderly African-American men as we do elderly European-American men, and make those comparisons. We haven't, across all these studies, seen any evidence for differences by race or socioeconomic status. There are some small differences in emotion that are expected ones by gender. Women experience more emotions than men, positive and negative, and more intense emotions. But there's no interaction of the gender effect by age. So we're seeing the same age changes for women and for men. But it looks like we're seeing this across very different socioeconomic groups and at least two racial groups in the U.S. Thank you. Yes? There has been a fair amount of research on wisdom. Most of it has been done by a group at the Max Planck Institute in Berlin, and their model of wisdom is what I call a very cold cognitive model. It's really how well you can solve hotly charged societal issues. You know, what should a 13-year-old girl comes to you and says that she's pregnant, what should she do? And then they measure the quality of the answer and get judges and so on to make those determinations. And it's interesting research, I must say it really is, but the one thing they were criticized for, and I think so too, is that there's no deployment in it. It's just, can you come up with an answer? But it's really, you know, when do you fold them and when do you hold them? You know, that's about emotion as people get older. And my guess is, however, that because knowledge increases with age, and especially knowledge about practical matters of life, that's going up. And given that emotional well-being and regulation and stability is also going up, it makes sense to me that wisdom would be more common among older people than younger people. Yeah. Yes. Yes, older people do care more about the world. They care more about the environment. They care more about social justice than younger people do. In fact, there's some lore that older people become more conservative. So as you get older, you're more conservative. Not true. In fact, but with age, people become more personally conservative. So the way people live their own lives may have more routine to it, certain beliefs you've held, whatever. But with age, people also become more open to other ways of living. So it's a kind of interesting, you know, combination of things that goes on here. I believe what's happening, and the reason older people aren't sinking by paying attention to the world, is that they pay attention to the world and then they try to go do something about it or decide that they can't do anything about it and then put it aside. And younger people are watching the news and they can't pull themselves away from the faces of the people in the earthquake or the tsunami. You know, they're glued to it and they ruminate about it. And I think what happens with age is people watch it, they care, and they get up and they go write a check, or they get on the phone, or they volunteer. They do something in response to the negativity, as opposed to just get pulled in and you just kind of have it weigh you down. I think that's what happens. There is a prize, you all probably have heard of it because it's given by Civic Ventures. It's based here in San Francisco. It's called the Purpose Prize, given to older people who have done exceptional things in their communities. And one of the recent Purpose Prize winners, who had done just started this extraordinary company, had said he got to an age where, I'm going to try to get this quote right, he said, "I was old enough to know injustice when I saw it, and experienced enough to do something about it." And that's the ideal combination. I think that happens to a lot of people. Yes. What about us boomers? Yeah. We boomers. There's a lot of disappointment in the world I live in with boomers. I'm counting me squarely, you know, amidst them. We were very idealistic as youth. In our youth, and I think we did some great things, actually, and then we dropped the ball. I mean, I think we did great things with the Vietnam War. You know, people said, you can't do anything about it, and we said, yeah, we can, and we did. Wow. But what happened is we got distracted. We started to raise our families and to pursue our own careers, and we sort of fell out of that. My hope is that we now return to that with that same passion and now a lot of knowledge about how to make things happen and solve the problems of aging societies and turn those potential problems into great gifts, because the boomers are going to set the stage for what this new long life is going to look like, and we've got an opportunity to turn it into something that's never before been experienced. And I've got faith that we can do more, but I'm a little more cynical about how much we accomplished.
So why didn't the generation after us do the same thing that we did?
Because we did. They're our children. That's easy. I know, I'm a psychologist. I can figure that one out. But yes, you had a... It's a great question. So why, if older people can see injustice, why are they tolerating elder abuse? It's a great question. I don't really know the answer. I guess I'd be hesitant to say they're really tolerating it. What does that mean? I mean, have we not solved that problem yet? Yes, we have not solved it. Elder abuse is a really, really hard one to solve as a group because it's so private. You know, people don't know when it's going on.
So many of them, when they're asked by
certain children, will deny it. Oh, this is true, too. Right. Actually, this is some of the work on fraud is related to this. If you didn't hear, she said they deny it. People of all ages deny it, but... we've been doing some work with FINRA and with ARP and with the SEC on trying to get these rates of victimization. Here's what we know. We know that older people are targeted by scam artists more than any other age group. We don't know that they're more vulnerable. They may be, and as I said, I think there's some reason to think they might be, but we don't know yet whether they are. But what we do know is that reporting rates are really low. So what the feds have data on people who are known victims. So they have these lists of people who have been victimized, and then they call them in a survey without, you know, just clean, no knowledge of that, ostensibly. Have you ever been a victim of financial fraud? About 40% of people say no. And they're documented victims of financial fraud, but they say no. Now, you're seeing this across ages, but you're certainly seeing it in older people, too. And given what I've just told you about the positivity effect, I wouldn't be at all surprised if older people do that more even than younger people do. So it's a problem. Yes. We haven't found a way that we can instantiate this shift in time horizons and do like an fMRI study. Because, you know, you say to people, imagine this, and then you're going to put them in a study for an hour, and they don't retain it. So it's hard to do that. We can do them where we say, imagine this, now make this choice, you know, right there. But it's hard to get it to last. We have toyed with and tried and not been very successful yet with actually training people in a Buddhist meditation on death to see if we can change time horizons that way and then do this. But we so far haven't been successful with the manipulation itself. So we haven't done so well there. Cross-cultural differences and positivity effect. We published one study a couple years ago that Yuk-Yung Kwan, a postdoc in my lab at that time, ran in Korea. And she used the same stimuli we had used in studies here, went to Korea, ran this study with a Korean sample, no evidence for positivity effect. And then we're sitting in my office and we're talking about this, and I said, you know, but do those images, do they mean the same thing, you know, to people, like a coffee cup, a picture of something, you know, is that neutral? And so she went back, and we always collect ratings of those images, you know, how positive or negative are they after the study's done. And she went back, and there were very different ratings. So in Korea, a picture of a coffee cup or a teacup is positive, and in the U.S. it's neutral. And when she recoded them according to their own ratings of what's positive and negative, you saw the same effect appear. So I think there are cultural differences in what's positive and not, but this shift looks like it holds across. Now, there are certainly lots of cultures we haven't examined, but this has been run in Germany and Hong Kong and mainland China, and we see similar kinds of findings there. Great question. Thank you. Yes. Yes.
I was wondering, is your criteria for placing a person in the old category changing?
Yeah, it gets older and older. Yeah. You know, old age is 10 years older than however old you are, right? Isn't that right? We calculate age in a lot of different ways in different studies. And as you know, 65 is the number, right? Which really just dates back to Bismarck, and who had to have an age where people were eligible for the German pension plan, and we stole that number, and that became old age. Nothing magic about 65. But we tend not to use 65 anymore because we think people at 65 are children, basically, from our perspective. But we'll usually start old age. Typically, it'll be like 74, 75. We would start and say people 74 and older. And then for the young end, we don't run people usually in their early 20s because they're students, and a lot of them. And we don't want to confound student status with age. And so we tend to start a little bit older. But in some studies, like the study that I described to you that we did with the Catholic sisters, we just split it in half, so younger, older, but it was just a median split down the middle. And the study that I showed you, this longitudinal experience sampling study, it's just a one big sample where we look at age as a continuous variable. So, but in others, we do recruit specific age groups. Yes, yes. Good question. Are there studies of severe depression that leads into dementia? I shouldn't have said yes, I have done studies like that, but there are studies in the literature. Depression rates are lower in older adults than younger adults, and most cases of clinical depression in old age are in people who have a history, a lifetime history of depression. It's a recurrent disease, so people will get over one episode and it comes back, you know, a year or so later or years later. Couple things about it. One is that we know that this recurrence rate slows as people get older, so you're less likely, if you have a history of clinical depression, of having another episode as you get older. So that the likelihood goes down. What I'm told by the top depression and dementia experts is that when you see a brand new case of clinical depression in an elderly person, it's almost always related to an impending dementia, so that it's often the initial symptoms of what goes on to be a dementia. That's only in brand new cases. So you've got somebody who's never had a mental health history, you know, clean background, and then begins to get very depressed. That's often associated. But as I say, it's not common to see that outside of that specific situation. Excuse me?
Chicken or the egg on that one?
Chicken or the egg on that one, for those of you who didn't hear. I'm not an expert in dementia. I can tell you, though, that I read a lot about it. I know a lot of people doing the work in this area. I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that an emotional disorder leads to, in a causal way, to dementia. but dementia is an organic brain disease, and we don't know why people get it. We don't understand the cause, but there isn't any systematic evidence that would suggest it's the way people are living their lives emotionally that gets them to a dementia.
So you're finding then that the depression is an early onset symptom of dementia?
Exactly, right. That's what it looks like. That's what, yeah. Yeah. Yes. So what happens to whether you lean to the left or the right as you get older politically is one question, and then does happiness have anything to do with that? That? So it appears that political party is more deeply ingrained in people and more enduring than religion. People are less likely to change party than they are their religion. They stay. So if you were Republican when you're young, you'll be Republican when you're old. There's not a lot of shifting across parties in either direction. We did a study in our lab around the 2008 election, and it was a study on what we call affective forecasting. So it's, do you expect to be happy? And before an election is a good time to do that because people have these strong expectations. If Obama wins, it's all, hope. It's going to be great, Or if McCain wins, or the other way around, So I know we are in San Francisco. I didn't notice it. And so we ask people to tell us how they would feel after if their candidate won. And if their candidate lost. So they're making a prediction. How happy would they be? People are notoriously bad at this because you think, you win the lottery. Oh, I'll be happy forever. No, within a week, you're right back to your pre-lottery days. But so we wanted to know if they would do this. And it turns out that Obama supporters were better at predicting how they would feel after the election than McCain supporters were when they lost. So we'd ask them both, if you win or you lose, right? So we have a little bit of evidence that happy people are Democrats. But we don't have the control condition. We might get it in 2012. So it could just be that your older people predict better how they're going to feel when they win than when they lose. And there's no difference by party. But we'll run it again in 2012, and hopefully we won't be able to test that hypothesis. Yes.
Thank you, Dr. Christensen.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.